Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. That's what we were reading as a church last week. A few points of clarification. If you've been following the blog emails, Ezra and Nehemiah, this section is not a portion I had studied in great detail in the past. I'm not sure if you had, but so a few of the things I shared through that blog were they're debatable. So one of those things I said was that Ezra and Nehemiah represented a unified work, which suggested likely one author. What is definably true about that is that these two books were paired together in the Hebrew canon. So they were paired together. And it's later that they get broken apart. What's not clear to me, especially after reading and rereading these stories, if they are shared authors or not, and if they are meant to be unified or not. That said, they certainly have lots of overlap. They tell the big story of returning to the land and rebuilding. And so that's there. The other thing I said was that the contents of Esther take place just antecedent, just prior to the contents in Ezra and Nehemiah. But parts of Ezra actually recount a broader period that envelop and include Esther. So that could have been a bit confusing. And the reason that is, as simply as I can state it, is that, and you probably recognized at least this, Ezra 1-6 deals with the initial history of the return of the land. Then you come to Ezra 7, and 7 through the end deals with Ezra's separate return. It's 80 years later that he's returning. Okay? And so that can be a bit confusing. We had multiple deportations, okay, and now we have multiple exilic returns. And to make it a little more confusing, the context that backs up our main passage today, which is Ezra 5 and the rebuilding of the temple, Ezra 4, right before that, if you read it quickly, it can sound just like a straight line chronology. And so you have multiple mentions of different kings. But if you look at a kind of a Persian a list of rulers, what you will see is that things are out of order. So as briefly as I can suggest here, if you look for just a moment at Ezra 4, which again is part of the background launching into Ezra 5, what most commentators will do at this point, and this is not controversial, most commentators will recognize that in chapter 4 of Ezra, verses 1-3 or verses 1-5 are one unit. It is telling a chronology. Here's what happened when the temple was attempted to be rebuilt. At this point, the altar's already built, the foundation's already built, but the temple is yet to be built. And there's opposition all along in these building projects, and that's clear in Nehemiah 2. Opposition, opposition, it's just everywhere. But it's particularly pronounced during the rebuilding of the temple itself and the rebuilding of the wall. So you have in Ezra 4, maybe it'll help if I read verses 1-5. You have a chronology that you can follow kind of flatly and simply. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do. And we have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." We'll get to that in a second. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua, And the rest of the heads of fathers' houses in Israel said to them, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." And the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia. Okay, and this is going to give you a historical timeline event that you can track. All the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Okay? And then what I would want you to do mentally is place a parenthesis on the next verse. So because Ezra wants to heighten this sense of opposition and oppression, he's 80 years removed. He's coming on a second exile, so he's not part of this temple rebuild. He decides to incorporate the longer history of opposition to the building projects. And so he starts bringing in kings that are a few kings down the line. So Cyrus is followed by Darius. So that chronology is fine that we've read before. But now he's going to talk about two kings that are after Darius. And again, if you don't recognize he's making the parenthetical note here, you'll think Ezra has no idea when these kings reigned. And they'll seem kind of twisted up. And so in between there, all the way from verse 6, see, now he brings in a third king. In the reign of Ahasuerus, also the name for Xerxes, this is most likely the king we encounter in the book of Esther, right? In the reign of Ahasuerus, Xerxes is the Greek name, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And then we have an additional king. Now, some might suggest that verses 6 and 7, they're referring to the same king. Part of the issue is verse 7 refers to an Artaxerxes. So we got a fourth king's name here. Some would say those two are referring to the same. And Artaxerxes is a very common king name. It's tied to at least three Persian kings. So there's a lot of chronology trouble you got to work through here to make sense of things. I believe in verse 7, it is referring to this yet fourth king, who is the king who actually sends out Ezra, as referenced in chapter 7. So he sends out Ezra, and then later in his reign, in the 20th year of his reign, Ezra was the 7th year. I know there's a lot of data. In the 20th year, it's Nehemiah who's sent out by this Artaxerxes. So Ezra brings all of this history. I think this is really the only straightforward, sensical way of reading this passage. He brings all the history of oppression through these other kings into focus to highlight the current oppression he wants to describe in the actual building of the temple. And so that whole passage from verse 7 all the way down to 23, it just deals with letters going to and fro from Artaxerxes and these decrees being issued and Artaxerxes being concerned at the potential revolt of Israel and saying, okay, you've got to stop them building. And another thing that helps you recognize this reading is the right reading is he's referring to the building of the wall in that section. So he says, you got to stop building Jerusalem and the wall. But remember, the first couple of verses, they were just referring to the building of the temple. So that parenthesis that I wanted you to put at the beginning of verse 6, it's going to close out at verse 23. Does that sort of make sense? Okay? And so at verse 24, you have a continuation. If you wanted to, if you didn't want to follow, if Ezra didn't want to make this literary point of emphasizing the oppression, he could have followed a straight line chronology by simply ripping out verses 6 to 23. And that's why verse 24 will be almost, it's really a redundant copy of verses 4 to 5, where he had spoken of Cyrus leading into Darius and the cessation of the work. So remember, the end of verse 5 was all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Okay? So those are two closely related kings. Darius after Cyrus. In verse 24, he does the same. Then the work on the house of God that is in Jerusalem stopped. So he's talking about the temple rebuild again. And it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So, I just wanted to give that helper, if it was confusing, if you followed a close reading, because otherwise, it just feels like Ezra doesn't know who's king. And there's, but he's bringing, trying to think of the exact dates, he's bringing like 80 years or more of kingly reigns into this rather short, this short experience of building the temple, which took closer to 20 years in total. So that's part of the background there. All right, I just want to give you now a little bit of idea geographically of where we are. So remember, the northern kingdom is squashed by Assyria a few hundred years earlier. The northern kingdom has been defeated by the Assyrians in 722 BC. And then the Assyrians play a tricky game with population. I'll get to that in a second. But when Israel falls, it falls in stages. There's two or three deportations. I think the first is described in 2 Chronicles 24 with Jehoiachin. And that's around between 605 BC and 609 BC. And then you have the subsequent deportations. The final one is around 586 BC. Okay? So that's when the temple is utterly destroyed. That's really, right? That's the closing bell right there. The temple's destroyed 586 BC. And the people are sent all the way out to Babylon, out by the Chaldees. Does that remind you of anyone else who once came from the Chaldee district? Abraham. So we are intended, I think, in this story to understand the immense turn of events in Israel. Sometimes when we're reading, we're just sort of seeing them rise and fall, rise and fall. But amid all of that trouble and wandering and being in the land with the judges, being in the land with the 20s of kings, you might get lost in the sense that Israel's always going forward and coming back. But this is massively different. They're totally repelled from the land, which was part of that Abrahamic covenant. You're going to go into this land. And they're totally cut off. And it took a long time for it to happen, and a lot of grace, and a lot of patience. And that's what's described at the end of 2 Chronicles. So 2 Chronicles, just to read the chronicler's summary of the Lord's patience and really having no options, his last play is to move the people all the way back to where the whole story started with that covenant with Abraham, all the way back to near Ur. So from verse 15 of 2 Chronicles 36, the Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers, he's referring to the prophets, by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. This is not a God described as being quick to anger. And if we're looking at the history, we have to recognize that. He had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, but they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, until there was no remedy. So this idea that the God of the Old Testament is just constantly raging, constantly judging, we have to understand the people who were constantly unfaithful and who were kept in this land well beyond what their actions merited. So the conclusion continues, therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion. So you have the compassion comparison, the compassion of the Lord, but when the enemies come, they have no compassion. Had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its precious vessels. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths all the days that it lay desolate. It kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. And so we remember here, these 70 years are prophesied. The 70 years explicitly are prophesied by Jeremiah in chapter 25 and chapter 29 as well, especially verse 10. And there, Jeremiah also promised a return to the land. So not just the removal, but the return. So this is, it's going to require massive prophetic fulfillment for this immense turn and the sending all the way back, for that to then turn in just 70 years. I mean, what would make the people give up their servants that quickly? What type of strange event? I had asked you in those email blogs a while back if you could recognize the other prophecy that spoke to the person who had sent Israel back. Does anyone know at least who the prophet was that prophesied the return to the land by Cyrus? Who? So, Daniel's already in exile, so his, though he might make reference to it, he's not the one I was thinking of. I was referring to a prophet who is in the middle of the king cycle. So he's prophesying of Cyrus. He had exercised his ministry from around 740 BC to 700 BC, so well before the decline, and it's Isaiah. And so Isaiah, just to encourage your faith here, Isaiah predicted Cyrus 200 years before Cyrus, by name. He names him by name. And he says he would be like a shepherd. And he actually uses the term, it's the only time it's used of someone who's not Jewish, he calls him an anointed one, a Mashiach, Messiah. And so while we obviously understand that to be used in a general sense, it's going to require a messianic work to get these people back in the land. Because the people who just took them over, they did all the work of destroying them and bringing them out of that land. They're not naturally going to give them up. And of course, they wouldn't give them up. And so this prophecy speaks of someone coming in to depose the Babylonians. And that person would be Cyrus the Great. Just for a skeptic, someone else who says, you know, someone could have after the fact tweaked Isaiah or put that prophecy in, or, you know, how do we know it was even Cyrus and it wasn't some other king? And you know, what other evidence is there? And you know, when you're looking back 2,500 years, it can be a bit tricky to find living evidence. However, If you've never heard of the Cyrus Cylinder, I'd introduce you to the Cyrus Cylinder, an artifact found here that speaks specifically of the Edict of Cyrus to restore. So I'll just read you what you see on the screen here. The Cyrus Cylinder, it's a clay foundation. So clay foundation cylinders were often placed inside the walls of buildings in order to preserve a record of a king's achievements. It's somewhat like our putting a time capsule in a building. The cylinder recounts the conquest of Babylon in 539. So that is the cataclysmic event that will allow Israel to return. But still, what type of king is just going to send off a people, let alone tell it to go build their temple? Well, this king. And it confirms the decree given by Cyrus, the king of Persia, allowing exiles to return to their homes in order to rebuild their temples. And so you get the return from exile. It's probably about a 900-mile trek. Remember last week I told you about that 1,400-mile trek that the Queen of Sheba had to come? I said that was a number of weeks. Just for perspective, this trek, which was only 900 miles, took probably 8 to 10 weeks. And so they make the long trek. They'd have to go north because you don't want to go through the desert, and then come back down. This next map is just to show some of the data that's referenced in Nehemiah and Esther. So you get references to Susa there. That's because now Persia has taken command, okay? And one of their main operating centers is Susa. And so it's a little bit sort of east, southeast of Babylon. So you can see the two flags there from Babylon to Susa, okay? And so the people return. But among all the things that make this return really tricky, and certainly any type of building project really tricky, you've got people in the land that you have to deal with. And in a way, Israel has to kind of restart what they went through to take the land initially. Because people aren't going to just leave good land alone. Even if it's fairly desolate and a lot's been broken down, where you have a void, people are going to fill that. And so when the exiles return, there's some people in the land who have different interests and feel a certain level of entitlement. And one of the things that makes it more complicated is they've been sent there by decree. So remember I'd mentioned the Assyrians, when they defeated the north, that tricky population thing they did, they used this population shifting tool to weaken the people. Because if you're around your people, even if you're a remnant, even if there's just a couple of you, it's amazing what a few people banded together by conviction and resolve can accomplish. The Assyrians apparently knew that. So what they would do is they'd take people from different pockets, maybe some different religious practices, and then they would mash them together. And so you have the people of Samaria deported out, lots of them, and then you have people coming in from Susa and Babylon and these other locations. And so the Assyrians are mixing it up. And so the resettlement is really the grounds for a lot of the drama that plays out in Ezra and Nehemiah. And you just see this opposition everywhere. It begins to be described in Ezra in chapter 3, verse 3. And just note here, the fear of the returned exiles, the primary fear, although they were under, you know, different regimes over time, and would be from here up till Rome, that wasn't really the primary driver of fear and concern, at least at the start. The primary nuisance and annoyance and frustration was the people in the land who felt like they had a right to it and had interests that were divided from them and didn't exactly want to see things returned to how they used to be. And so you have the peoples of the land being the primary opponents. This is what helps us start to make sense of Ezra 4. After the rebuilding of the altar, the rebuilding of the temple, the rebuilding of the temple foundation, okay, so the altar's done, so we can worship the Lord. The temple's done in the same spot. Not going to put it in a different spot. That's the spot that God gave us. And now the temple needs to be built upon it. But this is going to be a stench in their neighbor's nostrils. And so when we read that passage of chapter 4, those first five verses, there's two ways to read it. One way is that these people who were of the land, and they were their enemies, when they recognized the growing rebuilding of the people, they recognized that it was better to be connected to these people than remain enemies. These people were you know, on this building rush, they were putting it together, and so you think, it's better to be friends with those guys. So that's one take. And if you take it that way, the response of Zerubbabel and these other leaders seems extraordinarily harsh. They say, no, you're not going to lift a stone. We don't want your money. We don't want to see you on the premises. We don't want you checking things out. We've got a decree from Cyrus, and no one but us is touching it. So that's kind of one read. It seems extraordinarily harsh. I think it's probably the poorer reading, though it's, you know, legitimate. I think with the introduction that Ezra gives us, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard, and then when you see his summary points in verse 4 and 5, after these enemies are rejected, the people quickly turn from being supposed supporters, very quickly turn from earnest, we'd love to help you build, very quickly to, then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah, made them afraid to build, bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purposes all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So I think probably the better, safer read here is that this was a disingenuous offer. They were aiming to frustrate the people and slow things down. And you see that type of dynamic in Nehemiah. And so they say, the people of Israel are saying, look, we've done a lot of things poorly. we have made a lot of compromises. This is not going to be one of them. And so I tend to think this is a righteous choice by them. So let me just read for us and let that kind of guide us the rest of the way. Read for us chapter 5. Because now again, we're focused on the rebuilding of the temple. This is not in Ezra's time. This is not when he's ministering. But he's recording this opposition and also this failure of heart that creeps into Israel. And the more I've reflected on it, the more it makes sense. It seems there is no physical decree at this point, at the beginning of chapter 5, during the building of the temple. There is no decree that we know of that has risen up to counter Cyrus's initial. Cyrus says, you're going to go back to the land, and you're going to build, and he gave tangible assistance to that project, right? But something has stopped the process. And I've emphasized that it seems to be not some ruling powers, but it's actually those who are close at hand, who maybe we would say, they don't have any tangible power there. They don't have any tangible authority. But people can impose their authority on us, can't they? You know, I think about what would frustrate the will of this church more to persist in services. Would it be a decree from on high, a federal government decree? Or would it be if our neighbors came up and surrounded the church and were pleading and barking and telling us not to operate service? I mean, what would be more intimidating for us? What would be harder to resist? And so it's that closeness of the people who are ever watching that's this primary threat, and it does work. It does cause a failure of heart among the people. And we see that constantly playing out in Nehemiah especially. The people are almost always ready to drop their stuff. And Nehemiah's like, no, you got to strap on your sword. You strap on your sword on this side because you can't do all the building tools because they might attack us. And then you got your building tools on this side. And so there's this constant tension. But at least from chapter 4 going into chapter 5, it's working. It's working. The people's pressure that is mounting around them, it is working because the temple has ceased to be built. And it requires prophets to rise up and rebuke them for their misplaced fear and rebuke them for being slack in their work. And so we're introduced to those prophets and the rebuilding begins even as pressure mounts once again. So all that's in the background. Let me read here. Ezra chapter 5, beginning verse 1. Now the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So even there, he's reminding them who's really in authority. The God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, he's the governor here, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, so he's the high priest here. Zerubbabel and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Okay, so these prophets are enough to boost their confidence and get them back to the work. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, so this refers to anything beyond the Euphrates. Kind of the Euphrates cuts right through Iraq. I was going to show you the modern day, but we won't have time for that. But the Euphrates cuts through the middle of Iraq, up into Syria, and then curves upwards towards Turkey. And so this, just so we understand, the province is this massive province from the Euphrates on. So any beyond the river, it's that, you know, this is way beyond the Jordan River. It's all the way over to the coast there, as far as the Persians have gotten power. And of course, including Judah. So Tattenai is recognized as a governor. He's probably a governor over top of Zerubbabel, who is the local Jewish governor. He enters the scene. Picking back up at verse 3. At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates came to them and spoke to them thus. Who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure? Who gave you guys permission? What are you doing here? And we might think, hey, I thought there was no decree canceling Cyrus's. I thought there was nothing standing in the way. However, there's been transition of power. Now we're on to Darius. And between Darius and Cyrus, there was a struggle for power. And there's some revolts starting in different places. And so Tattenai is probably a relatively new governor, and he may not be that familiar with little old Judas Temple and this decree. And when Cyrus allowed people to go back to their lands and build temples, it wasn't only the people of Israel. And so this was kind of a bigger program. So that's how we can make sense of the governor coming on the scene and not being aware of Cyrus's decree. So he's asking him, who gives you permission to finish this structure, build this house? Verse 4. They also asked them this. What are the names of the men who are building this temple? Ooh. But the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report should reach Darius, and then an answer be returned by letter concerning it. So even though there's not express opposition, there is not a decree against them that they've got to stop, there is constant pressure, even with the blessing of Cyrus. There is constant pressure in every direction to do what the Lord has commanded, do what the Lord has asked. And that, at least, remains this day. There is pressure for us everywhere we turn and in every square, in the political and in the local. And it's not that everyone is always out to get us, but you can expect and know and be prepared that especially as you carry out the work of the Lord, not just as you seek to be a good citizen in your own place, as you seek to expand the kingdom of God, you will meet oppression in all areas. But you will also find strange help at times, like the help of Cyrus and the help that would come here. And so the eye of the Lord was upon them. This is a copy, back to verse 6. This is a copy of the letter that Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and his associates, the governors who were in the province beyond the river, sent to Darius the king. They sent him a report in which was written as follows: to Darius the king, all peace. Be it known to the king that we went to the province of Judah, to the house of the great God. It is being built with huge stones, and timber is laid in the walls. This work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. Okay, now these people are working. Then we asked those elders and spoke to them thus: who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure? We also asked them their names for your information, that we might write down the names of their leaders. And this was their reply to us. I think a rather bold reply. It is not outright disobedience or revolt, but it is subversive. This was their reply to us: we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the house that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and finished. But because our fathers had angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carried away the people to Babylonia. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, Cyrus the king made a decree that this house of God should be rebuilt. And the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought into the temple of Babylon, these even Cyrus the king took out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. And he said to him, take the vessels, go and put them in the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its site. Then this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God that is in Jerusalem. And from that time until now, so this, interesting how they respond here, from that time until now, they're not acknowledging all the pausing in the work, which is probably a wise move on their part. From that time until now, it has been in building, and it's not finished yet. Therefore, if it seems good to the king, let search be made in the royal archives there in Babylon to see whether a decree was issued by Cyrus the king for the rebuilding of this house of God in Jerusalem. Let the king send us his pleasure in this matter. And I'm sure you know the end result. The search is made, decree is found, and there's just like decree after decree after decree. I was going to show you two words that are really prominent in these books. I guess I can do that quickly. One is exiles. Ezra is constantly referring to the people as exiles. And you might think he just does that in the first six chapters because it refers to the initial deportation. But even 80 years later, when he returns, he uses that word just as many times. And so there's a sense that the exile never really ends. The exile has entered the heart. The other word that plays up big, and interestingly, it only shows up in Ezra and Daniel, two exilic books. is the word decree. And that is absolutely loaded through this section of narrative, especially chapters 4 to 8. There are just constant decrees back and forth. And the people are at the will of this dictate and that dictate. And now you're telling me to sit. And now you're telling me to stand. Now I can build. Now I can't build. Can we do the wall? Can we not do the wall? And Artaxerxes, the one who says, don't do the wall, is then the one who sends out, apparently, Nehemiah saying, build the wall. And so you have so much living intention as these exiles. But then you have this mercy of the Lord. And a decree comes at the hand of the Lord to bless them. And the warning that is supplied with this decree, I think, is where I'll kind of settle us down and finish our time here. In chapter 6, we have the account of this search being made for Cyrus's decree. We have it found and reestablished. We have the blessing of the building happening. And we also have a very stiff warning placed upon anyone who will oppose. This must have been received with great joy. These people are constantly in opposition, and it wouldn't end here. Obviously, they would face it again when they would build the city and the walls and the gates. But you see this intense warning to anyone that would frustrate them. So first, chapter 6, verse 7 is the blessing, telling the governor, keep your hands off this project. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild this house on its site. Okay, so just leave it alone. But then you get this additional warning, beginning with verse 11. Also, I make a decree that if anyone enters or anyone alters this edict, a beam shall be pulled out from his house, and he shall be impaled on it. Pretty intense. And his house shall be made a dunghill. May the God who caused his name to dwell there overthrow any king or people who shall put out a hand to alter this or to destroy this house of God that is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, make a decree. Let it be done with all diligence. Interesting here that he would point to the impaling idea. So this could be one of two things. It could be just as it sounds. You take a beam out of the house. Probably the person who is already deceased would be impaled upon the beam and would be stood up, which would be a tremendous horror and curse to the family because, A, it's not a proper burial. Two, obviously the shame of it, anytime you're lifting up a dead body like that. But three, it exposes the body to being eaten by birds rather than being properly buried. Hence, when Israel, even when they would hang someone on a tree, God would tell them, but you've got to take down the body before the body is, you know, attacked by birds or other animals, and it's got to be given a proper burial. The other possibility here, which I think is probably a bit stretchier, but I have a hard time to imagine we're not supposed to see a connection, is that crucifixion was not a non-judgment at this point. There was some at least similar type of crucifix type of judgment here. And even in the impaling, we can see a connection to the impaling of Christ's hands and feet upon the cross. And so I just want to think about, before we close, the amazing contrast here. You have all of this opposition to the work of God being done, all of this opposition to the building of God's temple, all of this waxing and waning of the people's hearts, all of these enemies abounding, and anyone who stands in the way of this temple would be impaled at a decree of this great king. But in the fullness of God's plan, when he would issue his decree, it would sound essentially the exact opposite. His great decree would be that the king of all the earth would be held up. He would be impaled in his hands and feet. He would be held up as a horror for all of his enemies. We see this very clearly described in the Gospels. It was very hard for Jesus' contemporaries and his disciples to understand. They knew that this Jesus was the Messiah. They knew that he was the anointed one. They knew that there's no way anyone could reasonably argue that all of the prophecies, and there's a lot we'll be reading soon, but all of the prophecies are fulfilled in this time of return to exile. There's nothing like a fulfillment of the return of God's glory, of the expansion of the people of God, of Jerusalem being described as a city that's without walls because of a multitude of people. There's nothing like that fulfillment until you come to Jesus Christ. And so after hundreds and hundreds, four going on 500 years of waiting after this exilic return, when Jesus' disciples follow him on the basis of him being the great Messiah, they understand this part of it, that part that was first expressed to Mary in Luke 1, verses 30 to 35. And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." That's the type of prophecy, that's the type of description the disciples wanted to hold on to, and that we would want to hold on to. No end to the kingdom. But when Jesus would describe what that would look like, what that would require to his disciples, they would absolutely fall on themselves in confusion. Jesus would say in John chapter 12, before his crucifixion, verses 27 on, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd that stood there heard it and said that it had thundered. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "The voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. We see the tension and the understanding of this forever king, but then a king who would die played out probably most clearly by Peter himself, who would at one turn, he would express confidence that Jesus was the Messiah. He would say in Matthew 16, verse 16, "Simon Peter replied, 'You are the Christ, the New Testament word for Messiah. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock, I think he's speaking of Jesus himself as the rock, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again, Peter got that. The disciples got that he was the Messiah. But who could expect that it would come at the cost of Jesus dying and suffering and raising again? And so right after this, when Jesus, it's the gospel writer Matthew says, right after this, Jesus began to reveal that he must suffer many things. He must suffer and he must die. Peter attempts to rebuke Jesus. This one who he recognizes as the Messiah, but he's not down with the means. And the Lord, who recognized Peter and said, the Father has revealed this to you. What a great word that must have heard. He then says the most damning thing that anyone could hear from Jesus. Aside from depart from me, I never knew you. He turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. It seems Peter wanted to build something more like the temple that was rebuilt. He wanted to build something like that. He wanted to see Jerusalem rebuilt to its former glory. But Jesus told him, and I think he's still telling us, you've got to keep your eyes on the kingdom that I am building and that the gates of hell cannot stand against. You've got to set your eyes on that kingdom. And if we think for a moment that this is just a weird, if there's any doubt that the New Testament is just taking things way out of proportion, there's no grounds for this. How could you expect the Messiah to turn and do this? Like, no wonder the disciples were so confused. The prophets never prophesied such a suffering, such a death. They would prophesy glory and the nations being shattered and Israel being powerful. And if you have a selective reading of the prophets, you could come away thinking that. Or you could read Isaiah. The same one who prophesied the decree of Cyrus as a general Messiah who would bring the people. He would prophesy of a greater Messiah who would bring his people back and bring many more. And he specifically said he would do it through suffering. So let me close. And let us be reminded at the decree that God made of suffering, which has issued us a decree of peace and forgiveness. And let us be at the work of extending that proclamation, that decree, above every other. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death. Although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, yet it was the will of God to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many, and all of us included. This great decree of suffering, this great decree of forgiveness and peace. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. Praise you, God. Your story is beautiful. It's more beautiful in reading than in any retelling. But we thank you. This is the story that you have written. This is the word that you have given. This is your decree. The people of God are forgiven. Oh Lord, may we share your message of forgiveness faithfully. May we point to Jesus faithfully. Oh Lord, as we face opposition on many fronts, Lord, my prayer is that we would face opposition for building that which you have told us to build. In Jesus' name, amen.